Hello and welcome to the Open Source Security Podcast, episode 53, with myself, Kurt Seyfried, and my partner in thought crime, Josh Bressers.
Thought crime, that's very clever. Well done, sir.
Well, just technically we've been admitting to felonies for the last 52 episodes. My partner in crime.
Oh, partner in crime, I understand. Yeah. It could be misdemeanor crime. It doesn't necessarily have to be a felony.
Well, I just, over the weekend, I learned a lot about various indictable offenses and whatnot, so it's, I'd like to avoid admitting to anything I should or haven't, definitely haven't done.
I see. That's fair. Yes. I can totally understand that. And I'm a huge fan of not telling people anything they don't need to know. In fact, it's always funny because whenever my wife and I have like a business dealing or something, or we're like buying a car or whatever, she's very willing to give up information without being prompted for it. And I'm always like, shh, stop telling them those things. You know, they don't need to know that. And she thinks I'm some sort of paranoid nut, which probably because I'm some sort of paranoid nut.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually got that comment from one of the other parents at school today.
That's when you know you're doing good.
Yeah. So anyway, so there's been an interesting development in, I guess, flight software.
Yes, and you promised to explain all of this to me, and I have no idea what's going on.
Okay,
so I will let you take it from here.
Okay, so I'm a classic, like, armchair aviationist, I guess is the word, aviation enthusiast? Yeah, there we go. sure. So I'm probably basically wrong about everything I'm going to talk about right now, but having said that, so traditionally, there's a concept in software and security in general called security through obscurity. Which basically is to say that by keeping something secret, it'll help make it more secure. And a lot of people hate this principle, and a lot of people like this principle.
It doesn't work. Let's just say that, okay?
Well,
at least in software security, it doesn't work.
Security through obscurity really doesn't work if you can't change the secret. So, for example, you have a password. The password must be secret, right? If somebody knows the password, they can log in as you. But with a password, typically you can change it very quickly and easily. Obviously, software is like at the opposite end of the easy to change spectrum. You know,
sure.
If you're trying to keep your software secure and unviewed, well, the second it becomes exposed, you know, it's going to take you days, weeks, months, years, decades to rewrite the whole thing. So it's just basically it's not possible, really, in most cases.
Sure.
You know,
I don't even think it's that as much as I think there's I've seen two kind of attitudes here. Is you've got encryption where people will say, if you don't know the algorithm, how can you possibly crack it? And actually, if you do any sort of research into cryptanalysis, that doesn't matter because they have ways to do this.
Yes.
And
that's the public stuff we know about.
Right. It's anyway. And then there's the kind of, I'm going to keep my source code a secret so the bad guys can't find bugs in it. And I think the history of Windows is kind of the body-ridden path that proves that does not work, right?
Well, the reality is there's a lot of security flaws that are trivial to find. I mean, cross-site scripting is a great example, right? You just plug in random wonky values and boop, out comes a JavaScript alert.
Yeah, that's true. And you generally don't have access to that source code.
Yeah. Well, look at what Tavis has done. You know, he was fuzzing Windows Defender software, and he apparently got tired. It was very slow on Windows, so he actually ported it over to Linux. We'll include show notes to that, because I don't even want to try and explain that. It makes my head hurt when I think about it. And he's fuzzing Windows Defender on Linux machines.
Because he's not
found, I think there was just a new article on the Register with him mentioned from yesterday or the day before.
Yeah. He just released, I think, 2 days ago from when we're recording this, his latest Windows Defender security problem.
Exactly. So, clearly you don't need access to the source code to find really nasty flaws. On the flip side, however, I wouldn't say that, like, just because you're open source means everybody's going to, like, look at your code, find the flaws, and fix them.
Right. And that was Eric Raymond coined the term Linus's law, which was what, with enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow, and that that law is false, right? That is not a law.
The trick is
made up nonsense.
Well, the problem is people have to know that they're looking for bugs. And quite honestly, most of us don't have time to go looking for bugs. We're so busy, like, fixing stuff.
Or even the talent, man. I mean, this actually came up just the other day at work where someone basically said, oh, look what I found. And I said, that's a security issue because of this, this, you know. And then I laid out what would happen. And it was a very complicated process. And they're like, oh, crap. Yeah. I said, you know, security guy ruins it again, you know, never fails.
Yeah. Yeah. So the reality is, I think if you're heavily relying on security through obscurity, you're probably going to have a bad time.
Yes.
Because quite frankly, the bad guys generally don't need to see it.
Even the good guys don't need to see
exactly.
it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And the flip side too is at some point, you know, everything leaks eventually.
That's true, and that's another story we can get to after you tell me all about this airplane, because I actually really want to know.
Yeah. So, okay, so basically, apparently, in a this is off of Bruce Schneier's blog. So in a proposed rule by the FAA, it argues that the software in an Embraer SA model ERJ, that's a, what does that stand for? Something regional jet. Enterprise regional jet? Whatever.
I have no idea.
Model 190-300 airplane is secure because it is proprietary. So to quote, in addition, the operating systems for current airplane systems are usually and historically proprietary. And I suspect that's more true for, like, legal reasons than actual, like, you know, security reasons, realistically.
That could be.
You know, you don't want your competitors to see your special sauce, right? Airbus versus Boeing.
Right, right.
Anyways... Therefore, they are not as susceptible to corruption from worms, viruses, and other malicious actions as are... Well, and of course, I hope to goodness sake none of these are running on Windows XP.
No, they're not actually. So this part I do know something about because I've had dealings with the FAA in the past is when you write software to run on airplanes. Now, there's a huge difference between software that runs on the ground and software that runs in the air. The stuff on the ground... there's a bit more leeway and you can start getting into general purpose operating systems. But the stuff that's in the air, basically it has to be custom written because you have to be able to show why every line of code exists in that. And then basically anytime there's a change, you have to show exactly why the code is changing, for what reason, and it has to be fully documented. So they literally can take this operating system that's running on an airplane and they can trace it back to the dude who wrote the first line of code, or dudette, I guess. You know, we won't be those guys. But you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's they can show the history, they can show the provenance of all of this stuff. It's crazy how strict it is.
Yeah. Well, the reality is planes are really expensive.
They're expensive, but there's also like that whole like people die if it crashes part, right? It's if your car crashes or stops working. It could be bad. You may or may not die. But if the plane stops working, like you're going to die, you know?
Yeah. But anyways, going back to this. So because access to the design details of these proprietary operating systems is limited to the system developer and airplane integrator, some systems installed in the Embraer model ERJ-190-300 airplane will use operating systems that are widely used and commercially available from third-party software suppliers. So I'm assuming that's stuff like the entertainment system or whatever.
Let's hope so.
The security vulnerabilities of these operating systems may be more widely known than the vulnerabilities of proprietary operating systems that the avionics manufacturer currently uses. So, I'm going to say they're not entirely 100% wrong, but they're basically mostly wrong. And I think they're wrong probably not for the reasons that people and you think they are. My first comment would be, again, you know, back to this whole source code versus, like, binary thing is... I'm pretty sure if we lease one of these jets and like do a memory dump of, you know, the operating system and everything, I'm pretty sure somebody like Tavis, given a week, could probably find something nasty.
He probably doesn't need a dump of it. You would just need some level of access. And I'm going to hope. Now, although there's that guy who claims he hacked an airplane and made it like turn or something through the entertainment center, right?
I think that was debunked, but the reality is I know on some models of plane, apparently now they are using a single physical data bus with essentially VLANs to separate, say, entertainment and avionics.
That's a bad idea.
Well, like, I agree yes and no, because here's the thing. This is a difficult trade-off because on the one hand, VLANs and that type of technology is quite well understood and reasonably secure. And the reality is adding secondary wiring to a plane, you know, it's going to be at least... several dozen, if not hundreds of pounds of wire and equipment, and that has a real long-term cost on the plane. Air Canada's subsidiary Jazz is a great example of this. So Air Canada has this like cheap flights thing called Jazz, and they took all the life jackets off all the planes to save weight.
Does it never fly over water?
It has to fly within like 20 or 30 minutes of the coast or something. So in theory, you can like glide to the beach if like it's, yeah, basically. So the flight is somewhat restricted, but they're mostly flying over Canada, right? They're not doing like cross ocean right. flights. But the reality is this, like even a cost savings of like 100 pounds over the like life of one of these aircraft is a lot of fuel saved, you know? So yeah, it's, I mean, on the one hand I am like, oh yeah, you should just physically separate this all out. But on the other hand, you know, that's like an extra 100 pounds or 200 pounds of equipment and wiring and everything. And that really does add up, especially across a fleet of planes. But what's really fascinating to me is that so there's an FAA bulletin, essentially special conditions, Embraer SA model ERJ-190/300 airplane flight envelope protection general limiting requirements.
I don't understand anything you just said.
Okay, so basically, when we started out with like planes, we literally had wires connected to stuff that you would like, when you pulled the stick, like say when you pulled it backwards, it would actually like pull on a cable that would physically move ailerons and
right.
like move stuff around. Right. And like, so, you know, flying was a physically demanding and exhausting profession. And you know, then you got things like power assist, like in your car, and eventually you got fly by wire where you essentially have like a joystick telling a computer, you know, like turn the plane to the right. And then the plane decides what to actually, you know, it turns the aileron or, you know, moves ailerons or
sure.
the flaps or whatever needs to happen to turn the plane in that direction.
Well, even outside of computer, there's a certain hesitation for a lot of people to think that, like, when you move the stick, you're just flipping a switch that then goes through yeah. a wire with as electricity
and well, you're tells asking something the computer to do another nicely.
Thing. Well, it doesn't even have to be a computer necessarily, right? It can basically be a switch that yeah. does something sort of stuff.
But yeah.
regardless,
it's all computerized now.
Right.
And well, yes. So, and what's interesting is, so, you know, as time goes on, we've gotten a better understanding of aerodynamics and crashes of planes. And so, for example, we have things like stall warnings, you know, like you're going too slow, so you get a stall warning, or you're going too close to the ground, so you get a proximity alert, you know, saying pull up. But as of yet, there are very few, like there are some specific things in flight systems for certain well-understood corner cases where the plane, some models can essentially take control and get you out of the problem before like the humans realize it's a problem. Right, because part of the problem too is with a lot of these aviation things, like if you have a problem and you don't react to it in 5 or 10 seconds, right. you're dead.
Yes.
You know, you're literally, you're going to hit the ground. So what it sounds like is, blah, blah, blah. This airplane will have a novel or unusual design feature when compared to the state of technology envisioned in the airworthiness standards for transport category airplanes. So basically what they're saying is this airplane has a new thing compared to all the other transport planes. And when they say transport planes, they don't mean just like transporting stuff, but they mean people as well. To be clear, these people planes will cargo. Hold people. Yeah, exactly. Just really bothersome cargo. this design feature is a new control architecture and full digital flight control system, both of which provide flight envelope protections. So what is a flight envelope? Well, a flight envelope is a fancy way of saying if you go outside the flight envelope, like you go outside these parameters, you die. That's
that,
it, right?
That sounds friendly.
The Air France disaster over the South Atlantic is a great example because essentially to fly in a very fuel-efficient manner, you have to fly very close to what is safe. And if you go a little bit slower or a little bit faster or a little bit too, you know, a slightly different angle of attack, the plane will stall or, you know, bad things will happen and you will die.
Okay.
So essentially these planes are, you know, flying in a manner where even a slight change in circumstances mean you're now up the creek without a paddle. But if you can fly that way reliably, you can save a ton of fuel, you can get there quicker, all these good things. And so what it sounds like is that this flight software is now sort of understanding the flight envelope of the plane and ensuring that it stays within that flight envelope. So I think like there's been cases, for example, of where people had the autopilot going, they were flying a certain speed, You know, and then they hit some weather, or they hit like, you know, hotter air or colder air, which has a different density. And that changes the characteristics of the flight and the flight envelope, and you can have a problem.
And the autopilot doesn't like that?
Well, what if they're like having a nap or eating their dinner and not really paying attention?
I don't know. I don't know how autopilot works at all.
Well, again, autopilot, so, I mean, depending on how sophisticated they are, some autopilots literally are just like keep you on a bearing.
Like a brick tied to the wheel.
Pretty much, yeah. And again, there was a flight that crashed up in northern Canada because they engaged the autopilot to fly a certain course, and that course flew them into a hill.
Whoops.
Yeah. The worst part is the second officer raised this concern and was overruled. Yeah, well.
What? Like,
yeah.
We're flying right at that hill. What?
What happened is the airport like had the world a VFR.
Politics today. We're flying right at that hill. Quiet, you. But anyway, sorry, autopilots. What does autopilot do today?
So there's a variety of sophistication, but like a variety of autopilots. Well, obviously the more sophisticated ones now will do, you know, they'll do things like keep you at a stable altitude, you know, regardless of, you know, kind of a little bit of variation.
Sure.
You know, they'll keep you on the same heading. Like, so even if you hit like, say, a wind coming across, you know, it'll turn you into the wind a little bit to keep you on course, you know, things like that, right?
Oh, okay. I gotcha.
Right, because well, you could hit a jet stream hitting you sideways at 100 miles an hour. Right,
that sounds if you're flying, terrible.
Well, no, it's people fly through the jet stream all the time, right? And a lot of airline routes take this into account so that they can, you know, use it as a tailwind to get there faster. But anyway, so the thing is with these autopilots, like the majority of them will essentially keep you on course, but they won't necessarily like keep you within a safe flight envelope, gotcha. Right? Like if And it sounds like this one is essentially it's that next level of smart. So that it will, you know, for example, if you hit a thunderstorm or something like that, it'll take appropriate action to maybe speed up or slow down or, you know, just otherwise reconfigure the flaps of the plane. Because here's a dirty secret, right? You want the plane to have as little drag as possible so that it flies efficiently. I don't think
that's a dirty secret. I think that's like the fundamentals of avionics, right?
Right, but the thing is they've pushed it very far now to the point where it's almost dangerous, but if you fly correctly, it's okay.
I got you.
You know? So when it works, it's great. And when it doesn't work, you know, well, yeah,
and I suppose die. Because, like, lift is one of the side effects of drag.
Yep. So yeah.
If you have no drag, by definition, you have no lift.
Exactly. And that's what happened to Air France over the South Atlantic, apparently.
Ah, gotcha.
So right? They basically fell out of the sky.
This sounds to me like self-driving airplane.
It's... Well, here's the reality, right? You could have a self-driving car and just give it GPS coordinates and, like, just hope to goodness that nothing gets in your way, right?
Sure.
You know, but obviously that would be insane and not very safe.
It's smart
and
enough to not hit things, though, right?
Well, and so that's obviously we have to take that into account, right? Because the situations change, deer come out of the road, other cars, whatever, right?
Well, have you seen that video of the Teslas detecting crashes?
Yes.
And yeah. It's like, as a human... I have no idea what's going on, and the Tesla already knows what's coming, and it's amazing.
Yeah, and so that's a good example of this, you know, in theory, this flight envelope thing, you know, can detect, we're losing lift because we're approaching our, you know, the ailerons are trimmed to, you know, make us very fuel efficient, but we're losing lift for whatever reason. Maybe I need to sacrifice a bit of fuel efficiency so we don't all die.
I'm comfortable with that decision.
Yeah. You know, but to make that decision in, say, a tenth of a second versus a human being, which may take, you know, 10, 30 seconds or a minute or two.
Yes. That's right. Yeah. No, I get that.
And that's a big difference.
Well, and not only that, you know what the thing that's going to be really cool, and I don't know if this system can do this, and it may not, but once these planes can start recording all of the data about all of their flights... Then they can start using things like machine learning and artificial intelligence to basically make the autopilot significantly smarter, right?
Oh, they already do that. For example, the engines. Here's the thing. For example, like when you buy a plane engine, you typically don't, like a lot of the times you don't buy them, you're just leasing them.
Right, right.
And I know the nicer, like the Rolls-Royce engines, the higher end ones that, you know, are like on 747s and whatnot, they essentially send back telemetry.
I remember like, that because that time. Plane that vanished was the Malaysian Airlines plane.
The Malaysian Airlines plane, exactly.
The engine people had some information about where the plane was, which basically said it's not where it was
based on like Doppler shift and whatnot, going back to the Inmarsat.
Yeah, yeah, which is wild.
Yeah. So, I mean, the thing is, like, a plane isn't like a car. These things are really expensive. And so quite often, the plane you're on, you know, the company operating it probably doesn't own it. They may be leasing it, dry leasing or wet leasing. So a dry lease is where you just lease the plane. A wet lease is where you lease the plane and a crew. And, you know, for all you know, that plane may not own those engines. Those engines may be leased. Because the thing is, like, there's a lot of aviation companies that, you know, they don't have the expertise to fix one of these engines.
I doubt any of them do. I mean, if you didn't build it, I'm skeptical you can touch it. Because have you ever seen what a jet engine looks like? Do you think a big airline can, though?
Yeah. Like Air Canada, for example. Actually, the Air Canada and several North American airlines have now moved all their major sort of repairs and refit down to South America, because it's actually cheaper to fly the plane down there and take it out of service for an extra 12 or 20 hours, but fly it down to a country where the wages are so much cheaper.
Sure.
To do all the maintenance and refit, you know, and like take the plane out of service for 3 days and like tear it apart and put it back together, basically.
Right. I've read about such things, actually. And yeah, it's a, because I didn't realize this, but most airplanes are in service for 20 or more years, which is just like crazy to me.
What is the, hang on a second.
And they like just keep taking them apart and fixing them, and then like they'll put in new seats or they'll put
until the airframe itself starts to crack.
Right, right.
Or, you know, the wings, you can essentially, yeah, you can just keep like replacing the engines and all the other bits. What is the B-52 service lifetime at this point? I think it's going to be 75 years.
That's crazy. Yeah,
they're planning till 2040. So that's another 20-some years, and it's been around for about 50 years so far. Yeah, it's a good plane.
I guess so.
And here's the reality. After what the F-35 and F-22 cost to design and build and produce, I don't know that we can actually have a large bomber program that wouldn't turn into a like trillion-dollar train wreck.
Well, you don't even need bombers anyway. Just drones, man. Everything is drones now.
That's the other problem. Well, the other problem, too, is I don't think the U.S. has ever sold the B-52 to another nation, right? So they can't, you know, kind of defray the cost, like, you know, with Canada and Australia and a variety of other nations buying F-35s, for example. So, sure. But no, this is interesting because, like, on the one hand, see, here's the other thing, right, is if the plane avionics system doesn't have, like, an interface you can talk to, like it doesn't have a Wi-Fi or a network port, you know, it's not on the internet, I hope. Oh, boy, I hope. You know, it's really hard to attack this thing. You know, you have to go like the Stuxnet route of like a USB stick or something.
Yes, and that's fair. This is a good reason to not tie the entertainment center in with the now self-driving airplane. But you're probably
all the airplanes are self-driving. Let's be clear on this. They're autopilot. Most airplanes spend something like 98% of their flying time on autopilot.
Right. Right. Well, you know what's going to be really wild? I wonder how long until we see the first flight that basically takes off and lands completely under computer control.
So that's already happened.
Has it really? Well, okay, with people on it.
I'm not 100% certain. I know the, I think it was DARPA.
I'm saying like a passenger jet, not like some DARPA crazy airplane that's fueled by like, you know, rodents or something. I mean, like an actual airplane. With not me sitting in the seat.
It's a tough sell. I mean, I suspect it will happen self-driving cars, because we'll get used to self-driving cars and giving up that control and that perception of control.
I don't know if it's going to be that hard to sell, though, man. I mean, liability, I feel like, man, self-driving cars are being – nearly everybody accepts them. And basically anyone I run into that says, I don't trust a computer to drive a car, and I say – you honestly think anything can be worse than a person? They go, yeah, you're probably right. Like, literally, yeah. I have yet to find anyone that's willing to stand their ground on this one. And I suspect airplane. Now, granted, pilots are highly trained. And so it's slightly different there, because it's not just like any Yahoo who, you know, paid $20 to the DMV and passed their crappy test.
Yeah.
Pilots are a different breed. However, I would still trust a computer over a person any day, because a computer doesn't show up drunk, the computer doesn't fall asleep, and I know the computer's going to do okay.
The problem is, you can literally hit realistic scenarios in flight that, like, nobody's ever accounted for, like Captain Sully with the "I've lost both engines."
Yes, and
on takeoff,
there are always going to be those kind of extraneous circumstances, and I expect that to be the case. And this is where it gets tricky. Is I can envision two scenarios. Number one is where you have kind of some sort of remote command and control room with qualified personnel in it that are able to, you know, kind of take over.
Well, you'd have to be able to redirect the flights because of weather.
And, well, the computer can redirect flights.
Well, but at some point you have to be able to tell the airplane, like, you cannot land here because, for example, there's a national ground stop.
Well, yeah, but why couldn't you? I mean,
well, I'm saying you can't just ask the plane nicely. You want to be able to, like you said, control it. Well, like,
I would assume there'd be some sort of centralized air traffic control system that's fundamentally making sure these planes... And part of it, too, is you're going to have to make sure the planes aren't too near each other. I would imagine when it's computer controlled, you'd want to keep them even farther apart, maybe, than with
probably
humans.
Closer, safer.
Yeah, you think so? I don't know. Anyway,
well,
you
computers
get the point,
can react a heck of a lot faster than people.
Here's the second part, though. The alternative is you just say there are going to be rare events and the computer is going to do its best, but sometimes it's going to crash. And that's even true of people, honestly, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Sully was an anomaly because you had a very experienced seasoned pilot that knew what to do. You know, if it was anyone else, that plane might have crashed.
The problem is the perception of control, right? Like, my understanding is a lot of people, their fear of flying is not a fear of flying per se. It's a fear of not being in control while they're flying.
The problem isn't flying. The problem's crashing, right?
Well, yeah. But the problem is they're not the one driving. Like, they have to trust somebody else to, you know, not crash the plane. And some people just can't handle that.
I used
and
to
I see the
like
same argument
fly.
With self-driving cars, right? I want to be in control of it. I don't trust a computer.
I don't trust me.
Like, yeah.
I don't trust
taxi drivers.
Way like, more. Yeah, right. No, I agree. I agree completely. So anyway, I used to be afraid to fly. And I didn't fly
really?
Very much. I was. I did not like it. And I don't know. I don't feel like it was a control thing. I just didn't. Airplanes are very bumpy things. And like, I took my first airplane flight, I'll be honest with you. I was 22 years old when I got in an airplane for the first time. I was very old. Right. I never flew. So I remember just, like, all the bumps and the weird noises and things happening. And I was always like, the plane is crashing.
You don't know what's going on, that lack of control.
You know, it might have been, because now that I understand what's going on, I don't get bothered at all. And in fact, I've been on flights where people were, like, screaming because we were, like, crazy things were happening. And I was just sitting there like, eh, it's fine. And I remember turning to the person next to me. I'm like, this happens. It's going to be okay. You know?
Yeah. No, I think I've been flying since I was, like, 4, maybe 3.
Nice. Well, my kids are the same way. They've been, I mean, they won't remember not flying because they've been on airplanes so much.
Yeah. And, yeah, I mean, it's a non-event because I trust in the system because, by and large, these are professionals with well-maintained machines, much more so than, say, a taxi.
Oh, man. I know. Actually, the most terrifying taxi ride I ever had was in Canada. Did you know that?
Oh, I'm sorry.
It was in Ottawa, in fact.
Oh, yeah.
I was, it was technically an Uber ride, but I was watching the map and I was worried I was being driven somewhere to be murdered. Luckily, I was not. But
yeah.
Anyway. All right.
Back to the flight control software. So, I mean, the thing is, one of the biggest things nowadays is it attached to a network and or the network being the internet, of course. And if it's not attached to the internet, bam, it's a lot harder to attack because, you know, some schmuck from Russia can't just like connect to it.
Well, so here's the thing I think of, though, immediately is if you have the equivalent of a self-driving airplane, you're going to have quite a lot of communication happening between the airplane and the ground. And you're going to have some sort of routed protocol, I suspect, even though it's going to be happening, obviously, over satellite or you know, ground to air, whatever. And the issue I could see being that if they have, say, a central kind of control flight tower, whatever you want to call it, right, keeping track of all the airplanes and telling them all what to do, kind of like air traffic control. I don't know what you even call it. But anyway, that is probably going to be connected to the internet because you're going to have many of them scattered around the country. And even if it's a VPN, like they're on the internet, which means people can get to the airplanes.
So right? Here's the good news. There's already an industry that has encountered and addressed and solved that problem largely.
Which problem? I mentioned satellites. Like 10 things. What about satellites?
Satellite control.
Well,
right? There's ground stations that control the satellites.
Yes.
Military, civilian, whatever. And, you know, and let's face it, satellites, they're even more expensive and cantankerous than airplanes. But right?
How,
and
how
if
many
it breaks,
these,
you can't go fix it.
How many of these ground stations are there? Are there a lot?
Quite
I don't
a few.
Know. Yeah?
The U.S. government and military operates a bunch, right? I mean, the GPS thing alone is, like, quite
The military is different because they have their, it's called CIPRNet, and they're kind of, you know, classified network that's very well controlled, right? I could, and granted, don't get me wrong, I don't think this is going to be a problem because for two reasons. First of all, I don't know if anyone's a big enough dirtbag to actually crash an airplane on purpose like this. I mean,
It's already been hypothesized. Remember, what was it? I want to say the Polish defense minister or prime minister or something like that, and his entire cabinet or something was aboard.
Yeah.
Oh, here we go. Yeah. Poland claims proof Russia caused presidential plane crash. So, yeah, it was the Polish president and his cabinet.
I don't think that's comparable to an airplane I'm going to be on. Okay?
No, but, you know, maybe somebody else important is on that airplane.
Let's hope not. I'll make a point of avoiding planes with important people.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's face it too. Even if they connect these things to the internet and they're using VPNs or whatever to communicate between them and whatnot, for the most part, this stuff works pretty well. And even if they get broken into, which will inevitably happen, if they've done it right, they're going to figure it out and deal with it quickly. I mean, that's just kind of becoming the reality of the world now, is people are getting hacked a lot. And if you have a very, very high-profile resource, you have to be extra vigilant.
Yeah. Well, I think in this case, we actually have economics working for us in the sense of you have airplanes, especially the commercial, you know, wide-body carriers, are a massive capital cost.
Yes, there's that. Right? Well, not only that, the FAA has a ton of power here. And if they tell you to do something, you're going to do it because you don't have a choice, right? It's not like an IoT light bulb where nobody cares.
Yeah. So I think that's, and to be honest, that's, you know, one of the reasons I would generally trust the system. Will there be problems? Yeah. Will people die? Yeah. I mean, that's the nature of almost any technological, you know, system, especially when you're moving people around at hundreds of miles an hour. But is it going to be safer than driving a car from point A to point B? Yeah, almost certainly.
Until self-driving cars are here.
True.
And then, actually, you know, that's one of the things I think about is self-driving cars are going to change the travel industry in ways we can't even imagine. Because, like, here's a great example is if I need to go to the East Coast is like a 13-hour drive for me, right?
Eesh.
I'm not driving that. I get on an airplane, I fly there, right? However, if I could get in a car, like, at 6 in the afternoon and fall asleep and wake up, you know, in Boston, that's sweet.
Yeah.
You know, I would seriously consider doing that.
I was reading an article talking about this, that it really, in theory, self-driving cars, especially if you go overnight, would just decimate the airline industry for anything less than 500-mile flights.
Yeah, right. And it would be way more convenient to do that. In all seriousness, the vast majority of my flights, I go there a day before. Because I can't, you know, I've got a morning meeting, so I cannot show up the day of, and then I end up leaving at like noon because it's the only time the stupid airplane leaves. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Unless I want to get in at 2 a.m., which I don't. So.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this would be, I actually hope that this, you know, in theory, this could result in like essentially all the regional air traffic being pretty much gutted. I'm okay with that. And, you know, just essentially maintaining the big hubs to fly people to Europe or Canada or whatever.
Yeah, I could see it, man. It's certainly possible. Well, not only that, the other thing I think of a lot is, so I live in an area where the O'Hare Airport is basically like the gigantor airport for the region. And it's 3 hours away by car. So I never drive to O'Hare because it's too far to drive. And also, I don't want to waste 6 hours of my life.
Well, between that and security and everything, you're looking at like 5 hours.
Yeah, at least. Exactly. But like if I could get in a car that was going to drive me there and I could like work or read or play video games or whatever, like I would seriously consider that because that would not be a waste of my time. You know what I mean?
Well, I think that's going to be a big thing is I know a lot of people who commute. And that's an extra 20, 30 minutes each way that, yeah, they can't work. They can't really do much of anything useful.
Yeah.
Other than listen to, like, books on tape.
Yeah. No, I get it, man. It's gonna be crazy. Anyway, all right, we're in the weeds. Speaking on the topic of security through obscurity, there was also the Microsoft leak that happened.
Yes.
What was it? Whenever it happened. That's when it happened.
I think about
last week, couple days, whatever. Doesn't matter. Yeah. Doesn't matter. So what basically happened was some guy found on an FTP site a dump of like 32 terabytes of Windows source code or something, apparently?
Terabytes of official and non-public. It was installation images, and they say software blueprints? What is it?
Let's just assume it.
20 years. What is a software blueprint?
It doesn't matter, because we're going to talk about source code and hiding source code. And then, of course, Twitter lights up. As it does, and this is what makes Twitter so much fun. Because everyone's like, oh, someone at Microsoft is freaking out. It's ruined their weekend, whatever. And I was thinking about this, and yeah, I'm sure there's people at Microsoft that weren't happy, but like at the end of the day, does it really matter? I don't think it does. No. I think Microsoft is so far past the point of believing their source code is some sort of security asset. Now, granted, there's trade secrets, and we won't talk about that necessarily, but as a security asset, I don't buy it.
Well, it says that the leak code is Microsoft's shared source kit. So this is, I'm assuming that is source code that they share with partners and whatnot.
Well, the shared source thing was, I've got a great story about this. So shared source was the thing they started where, like, if you were a university student or part of faculty or something, you could get access to Windows source code to do stuff, right? You could look at it, and I think you could build some of it. I'm sure you could send them changes, whether they took them or not. Who knows? Yeah. And you, of course, had to sign a phone book contract and all this. And I remember I was out for dinner one night with a Microsoft sales rep. This was right when shared source first started. And I don't even know if I worked at Red Hat back then. It was a long time ago. And anyway, I remember this guy looks at me and he says, why do you do this stuff? I don't get this open source. And I'm like, it's fun, you know. I've got all this source code. I've got all these tools. None of it costs money. I can work on it. I can contribute back, you know, whatever. And he looks at me, and like he was completely honest. And he said, but we do that with shared source. And it took everything in me to not laugh out loud at this guy. And it's like, I would love to educate you, but you don't get it, and I don't think you ever will. It's just, they are not the same thing.
No. My understanding is that, according to the article, it's things, it's not even close to what you would need to build Windows.
Probably not. But wasn't there a Windows dump once and somebody did find some security issues? I think it was
NT4?
It was a long time ago. Or
something like that?
But whatever. The point is, though, that Microsoft has a very mature, and when I use a mature, I mean like the granddaddy of security development lifecycle programs. And these guys have been through it all. They've seen it all. And let's face it, worst case scenario, bad guy gets a source code, they deal with it, right?
I mean, yeah. Well, just like with the stuff Tavis is finding.
Right. Well,
because he's found at this point probably, I haven't been keeping track of everything he's found, but it feels like a couple dozen really bad Windows-related security flaws in Windows and Defender and a bunch of other stuff he was looking at.
Everything. Tavis has broken
everything. Oh, you know, I'm thinking of all the antivirus that he beat up and then just kind of gave up on because it was so terrible. Or I don't know if he gave up on it, but...
So this is another part of this story is OpenVPN, right? There were two professional audits done of OpenVPN where people looked at code and they scanned the code and they did their thing, right? And they found a bunch of minor stuff. Then like some dude fuzzed it. He found a whole bunch of terrible bugs.
There were three other flaws that we didn't give CVs because they weren't exploitable in any way, shape, or form.
Here's the point too. It doesn't matter how hard you look at it. It doesn't matter how good your SDLC is. All it takes is some guy to show up and run a tool, and now you've got a new bug. And I mean that's the thing. Like even with Tavis can work on this stuff forever, and you know what? The next day he could come in and find a bug worse than anything he's found yet. It's the nature of this stuff.
Well, and it keeps changing and moving, right? It's not like we're, assessing a bridge for flaws. It's we're assessing all the bridges that are constantly being rebuilt and refurbished. Right. If you look at the churn rate in some open source code projects, the Linux kernel is a great example. Like how many lines of code are added, removed, changed every, you know, major release? And the answer is like, well, it's a lot.
You know, that would be really fun. I might do that. I should take the Git repo of the kernel and look at how many lines, because obviously you can only go back to when it was imported into Git, because, you know, a line is used in FTP site for source code management a long time ago. But it'd be really interesting to look at how many lines of code were in that initial commit that are still actually part of the kernel today.
Probably, even the license might,
Ignoring text files and license files and things like that, right? I'm talking about like C source code, and we can even ignore comments, but like actual compiled code, I'd be interested to see. That'd be fun to do too. I bet I could get GCC to tell me which lines were C, like which lines it compiles and which lines it doesn't. This would be a fun project. Maybe I'll do that this weekend.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, and not only that, but the underlying technology, you know, part of it too is, and this is what I love, is this technology is so complex that we have emergent behavior. Like a great example being the Qualys stack guard stuff.
Yes.
Like literally, whoops, you know, that didn't do what we thought it would.
Yep, yep. Yeah. So. You gotta love it, man. What do you do?
Yeah. Well, I mean, train people to react quickly when a flaw is found and get it fixed and get the fix out to customers and to users.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. I think that's the only answer, because even if you have the best security training and security reviews and whatever in place, it doesn't matter, because you still have software full of critical issues.
I'm sure it's out there, but I'm trying to think of a major vendor of software-related stuff that actually builds reliably 100% of their own stuff. Like, even the Sombrero thing is saying that we use third-party code in operating systems.
Nobody does. Nobody ever did.
The only thing I could possibly think of would be the Space Shuttle, and only because it's running, like, a code base from 1970.
The Space Shuttle doesn't fly anymore. And I'm sure it used... Well, I'm sure some of the airplanes. I bet this operating system that we read about is probably 100% proprietary.
Mm-hmm. But the whole... But no, I'm saying the plane as a whole includes other components. Oh, and that's what I mean is I don't think there's a single thing anymore that ships with software that is 100% like in-house.
You know what this is, though? And it's never going to happen. Because the
problem is you're always shipping somebody else's stuff as well.
Did you...
Be it open source or whatever.
No. You're on Reddit. So I know you saw this. Did you see the story about the guy who made the $1,500 chicken sandwich?
No.
Okay. So
it rings a bell.
This is old, I think, but it showed up on one of the subreddits over the weekend. And I've not heard this story before now. But apparently this guy decided he was going to like make a chicken sandwich, as in he's going to raise the chicken and grow the wheat. Yeah. And he like grew all the vegetables and everything to make this sandwich. And it ended up costing him $1,500 and took 6 months.
Yeah.
Right?
That's why nobody... Well, it's like the guy that tried to build a toaster from scratch.
The guy who tried to what?
The TED Talk. A TED Talk. This guy tried to build a simple electronic toaster from scratch.
That guy, that TED Talk was stupid. Like, this guy actually made a sandwich, right? The TED Talk guy, he made a wire, right? Like, it was
It wasn't real. Bad. The 6 months of my life were not bad. What was your favorite part of the process? I really enjoyed milking the cow. They were friendly and liked to be rubbed on the base of their tail. But it was also scary because the farmer was telling me that if spooked, they kick with what's called the death kick.
That burnt down Chicago.
Yeah, once, cows are mean.
But anyway, so here's the deal, right? This is why nobody writes all their own software, because otherwise you end up spending $1,500 on a chicken sandwich and it takes you
six months. Or even a basic network communications protocol. Like, have you not noticed all those places that, you know, use UDP and then try to make it into reliable delivery and end up badly recreating TCP?
Right, they create a broken TCP every time. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, and I think this goes back to a lot of, you know, what I've said about security is I think we'd be better off if we had people focus on using, you know, some of the better frameworks and just, like, please, for the love of whatever, don't write your own encryption or web server or whatever. Like,
the new use one of these professional stacks. Is auth. Don't roll your own auth. I know.
Oh, yeah. I just 2 weeks ago saw a new one mentioned on Reddit, and it was like, just all the why.
Because they can.
Yeah.
Because we finally convinced them not to roll their own crypto, so now they're rolling their own auth.
Which usually, and auth has to involve crypto now.
Yeah, it usually does, doesn't it?
Yep. Well, you how are you going to transport and store and verify secrets without crypto?
It's true. It's true. Oh, my goodness.
I guess the moral of the story is buy your groceries at the store.
Yes. Well, not only that, could you imagine the just absurdity if everyone tried to kind of grow and do their own thing for food instead of relying on, you know, essentially factory farms?
Well, we did that. It was called the agrarian, you know, the agricultural revolution.
That's true.
And like 98% of people spent all their time trying to grow food and not starve to death.
That's a good point. Yes.
And it kind of sucked. And then we did the Industrial Revolution, and it was not super awesome for a while, but it got better.
It did. And we cured polio, which is a big deal. Yep.
And now obesity is one of the leading causes of death globally, not just in North America. So huzzah.
We win.
Yeah, 2 billion people are overweight now.
Oh, yay. Whatever. All right, right. So the moral of the story is you have to work with other groups. You have to use third-party software. And so I guess our trick now is how do we vet third-party software?
Yeah.
And I don't think we're going to answer that today because that could be probably a 10-part episode if we wanted to cover it. But I think that's becoming the new issue. And I see a lot of people are being like, oh, open source, bad. But in reality, it's like, it's just a tool. You know, it's your hammer now. Go find some nails.
Well, more to the point, what choice do you have?
That too. You don't have
like,
one.
Like, do you remember? I mean, I remember when there were several very successful closed source web servers. They're mostly dead now.
The Microsoft one is still around, isn't it?
True, but that's only because, you know, Microsoft.
Right, right.
But nobody else can afford to do that.
Yeah, the other big one was the Netscape. Netscape had one, right?
And Sun had one, and there was that one from that company in Italy that was actually really quite efficient and nice. I can't remember the names anymore. They're just gone to the winds of time. And, you know, the more successful one now is, well, Nginx, which is, of course, open source, and Apache, the granddaddy, open source.
Yep, yeah.
You know, so, yeah.
Although the Google web server serves a lot of traffic, not that anyone can run it but them, but I don't even know what that is, if it's just some bastardized Apache or if they've written their own.
Who knows?
My suspicion is it's probably a whole bunch of open source put together.
I think they're smart enough to not completely suffer from not invented here syndrome, unless it's absolutely necessary, like, say, the Chrome web browser. But even that uses,
it started, you know, with WebKit and a bunch of other stuff. Right, it wasn't not invented here. It's just when WebKit became difficult to work with, they had to fork.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't blame them for that. I remember when that happened. It was kind of messed up. I think I was on their security team when that happened. I was on the WebKit security team at one point. I assigned all their CVEs. Man, that was a long time ago. I forgot that was even a thing. Anyway. It's time to call it, I think. Any parting thoughts, Kurt?
Yeah, I don't know. Hobby farming sounds fun, but animals
sounds
smell
terrible.
Funny.
Like, I love that I can go buy fruits and vegetables at the grocery store.
Yeah, I think fundamentally, I mean, specialization of economic labor, it works.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. All right, man. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Kurt, for a enlightening conversation, as always. We'll have the show notes at opensourcesecuritypodcast.com. We have all kinds of crazy stuff this week to talk about. You can use the #OSSPodcast hashtag to get a hold of us. We have links to Twitter and Facebook there you can use. And if nothing else, thank you, everyone, for listening. Kurt, you have a fantastic rest of your day.
You too.